Hey, Bruiser Buddies, this is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty.
Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser said it all.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
The reason why Axe and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. And thank you for joining us for... It's a special episode, but it's a somber episode. This episode is going to be our tribute to the great Wojo, Greg Wojciechowski. I'll be joined here in a bit by his longtime partner, manager, and friend, Dr. Jerry Graham Jr. And then after that interview with Jerry, where he shares a lot of his memories and stories and things of Wojo, because there was nobody, professionally at least, who was closer than Jerry to Wojo. And not only that, as you'll hear in the interview, Jerry and Wojo were friends for over 60 years. And, you know, I got to know Wojo a bit here in these last few years. I kind of made it a mission to track him down, break his shell a little bit, and get him to do an interview. And with Jerry's help, I did that. And I got to interview him. And that interview you'll hear at the end of the episode, I'm going to replay it here for you. But, you know, and I talked to Wojo a few other times here and there. And, you know, he was always really good. He seemed to like me, seemed to take to me, he told me I did a good job on the interview, which meant a lot to me coming from him. But Wojo was a great talent. I mean, he was a rare talent. You'll hear a lot about some things. As I talk to Jerry, you'll hear a lot of things about, from that interview I had with Wojo. But just for the record, I guess you should just state, right, Wojo passed away on August 12th at the age of 73. I'm kind of free-flowing here for the most part. I don't have a lot of notes. I just wanted to kind of let this flow and be a little heartfelt. But I do have a list here of some of Wojo's accomplishments. So listen to this. He was a two-time Ohio State wrestling champion in high school, an NCAA Division I and All-American champion in college. He was a four-time heavyweight AAU national wrestling champion. He was a 1980 Olympic team member. They did not get to participate that year because that's when U.S. boycotted the Olympics. He was an alternate for the Olympic teams, I think on three occasions. Jerry tells us those years. I don't recall those years. But he was not, you know, obviously when he turned pro, no longer did he qualifier as an alternate for any Olympic teams. He was a three-time WWA champion, a George Dragos Luthez Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame member, a University of Toledo Athletics Hall of Fame member, and a National Amateur Wrestling Hall of Fame member. Now that, I'm telling you, for a guy who pretty much stuck to the Midwest for various reasons, that's a list of accomplishments, amateur and pro. Wojo was great. And as you'll hear Jerry talk, not only was he great professionally, but he was great as a man. You know, of course, Wojo had some hopes of doing more. It never really fathomed that, worked out for him. But he was, that did enable him to be pretty active in his family life and his kids' lives and different things. And again, you'll hear a lot about that from Jerry. So I'd like to, you know, this is obviously right. I'm a Midwest guy at heart. This show covers Midwest wrestling a lot, and especially keys in the WWE. And well, you know, outside of, you know, Dick the Bruiser and maybe a handful of others, he doesn't get much more WWE than the Great Wojo. One of the standouts from the entire run of the WWE. Obviously, you know, the standout, I would say, from through the 80s to the end. Again, I'm not going to go into that. There's a handful of guys which I think are standouts, but obviously Wojo is the one that garnered the most attention. Rightfully so. So, okay, so let's take a brief break here. And when I come back, I'll have my interview with Dr. Jerry Graham Jr., where he shares stories, memories, and everything else of the Great Wojo. Then we'll have another break, and I will have my interview from a few years ago with the Great Wojo. So hang in there and stick around, guys.
And then right up there on top, the one that everybody's waiting to see, Flying Fred Curry, gets his revenge, gets his grudge battle against the world heavyweight champion, the Great Wojo.
You got it right, on top, and I am on top, and I'm going to stay on top. But don't expect a wrestling match. Oh, no, Curry's going to get hurt. I mean, I'm going to beat him. I'm going to beat him to bloody pulp. I don't care if I had to take him in a parking lot and beat him. It's going to be a brawl. It's going to be putting him out of business. Those drop kicks, that flying crap, that doesn't bother me. It's not going to work. He's just going to take a physical beating, a good whipping by the Great Wojo.
And I'm going to tell you something, you know. Wojo just said it all. Physical match. So Curry's got these little cutesy moves, these fancy Dan moves. It doesn't matter when you get physical and you get down. Wojo and I have been apart too long. And not because of him and I. You know what's been because of guys telling lies. Guys saying Wojo said this. Guys like that Mike Itu. Guys like that.
Itu did it.
That's right. Guys just like you. But I'm going to tell you something. Curry, you're going to be the first. You were there trying to buy Wojo's contract, trying to take advantage of him before. Well, now I'm going to get my revenge through the Great Wojo, because he's going to pound that little camel jockey face of yours into the boards, and he's going to drive it and drive it and drive it.
And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time we are doing our tribute to the Great Wojo, and we're joined by the longtime partner, manager, and of course friend, Dr. Jerry Graham Jr. Jerry, how are you doing?
Well, I've had better days, but for all intents and purposes, I'm ready to talk to you.
Well, that's good. I appreciate you joining us. We're going to talk. I mean, you and I we've talked about Wojo before. We have lots of stuff in the archives. You know, Wojo has obviously been a constant within your career. But do you remember, when was the first time you met Wojo? Do you recall?
Yeah, he was in the fifth grade, and I was in the eighth grade. And that means we've been friends for, if my math is correct, 63 years. We were at a grade school wrestling league at the YMCA, coached by Dick Toriel. And we, even though I was a little bit older than him, we became friends, and we would talk, and I would go to a wrestling match or wrestling meet, you know, high school we're talking about now. He'd come up to me and say, hey, do you remember me? I said, sure, I remember you, Greg. How you doing? And the funny thing is, a few years go by, and he becomes a big star, a big college champion. So I go up to him and say, hey, do you remember me? the roles got reversed somewhere in there. But, but I would say since fifth grade, so my man, this 63 years friendship.
That's unbelievable. And even at that, right, even in grade school, Wojo was bodybuilding, was wrestling. He already knew. I mean, he already had this passion, right? He was already an avid amateur wrestler.
He was going to Toriel's gym, working out with the weights, learning how to wrestle. And in fact, Toriel told me that when Greg was in the sixth grade, he told Joe Scalzo, who was a little bit older than Toriel and was the head of wrestling at the University of Toledo at that time, before Dick Toriel took over, he said, that kid there is going to be a national champion. And Joe Scalzo asked Toriel, how do you know that? And he says, because I'm looking at the determination when he works out. And Toriel predicted that.
Yeah. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And so when it got to the point, right, I mean, obviously, right, Rojo, national, I mean, he was a state champion in Ohio in high school, two-time, I believe. National champion, NCAA Division I, Olympic qualifier, although they boycotted the games, but then he was an alternate the next two times.
After he turned pro, he was an alternate in 1968, 72, 76, then he made the 80 Olympic team.
18.
And they boycotted it. Yeah.
In 68,
he won a national AAU championship.
Took
second place for the Olympic team, and he was still a senior in high school. How's that?
Yeah. 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 Well, and then obviously he turns pro. And tell me, what was that like? How did
How did that happen? Who approached who? How did the Wojo going from, you know, this standout amateur to working for you and Dick the Bruiser, how did that happen?
Well, he approached me. We worked out in the same gym. Torrio's had his own gym. We both worked out there. And one day after the 80 Olympic boycott, he came up to me and said he wanted to turn pro. And right then, rumors started flying in Toledo that I was, you know, trying to capitalize or take advantage of, talk Wojo to being a pro, which was not the case. He came to me. So we met at Torrio's gym for his first training session. And Dick Wilson, who was a three-time Olympic team member, was there, and so was Dick Torrio and some other. And I says, I need witnesses for this. I says, Wojo, did you approach me to become a pro wrestler? He says, yes. Did I approach you in any way, shape, or form? He says, no. Do you want to do this because you want to do it? And I wanted to go on record. I was not trying to take advantage of his name or his position. I went on record. He wanted to turn pro, and so then we had our first workout. I says, if you want to change your mind, now's the time. So he went on and rest is whatever it was, you know.
Yeah, and you had. I mean, you trained lots of guys, several guys, and I remember you telling me, right, Scott Steiner, right, a natural. You said right from the beginning, was Wojo that same way because of the amateur background? Was he just a natural?
Well, first of all, an amateur background doesn't do anything to help your professional status. There was many. Amateur champion that just couldn't make it as a pro because they just couldn't make the switch over. The sons did, of course, like Von Roschke. He made the switch quite easily, and so did what's his name, Kurt Angle, and so there's some guys. But it's, and Wojo and Steiner were pretty much even, and the fact that the attitude and the way they pick things up, there was a guy named Pete Lee. He was a big Olympic wrestling champion, a big tough guy, well over 300 pounds. And he wanted to turn pro. He contacted Bruiser, and Bruiser called me and says, you like to train these amateurs? Just Pete Lee wants to get into the pro. And some of the guys are telling me Pete Lee said he wants to come in. He wants to break a few arms and legs to get a reputation. And I said, I don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah,
I said, I won't do anything to stop him, but I don't want to train a guy that's going to go start breaking arms and legs. So, but I trained Steiner, and I trained Wojo, and I trained a lot of guys. I took they'd already been trained, but I gave them like their advanced course. Chris Carter, Muhammad Saad, a lot of guys. Carter's already in business, but I taught him psychology and other moves and what things are all about in the business. And but from starting from scratch with Steiner and Wojo and Andy Shane. But then there's other guys that come along and I tried to help. And and some of them did very well. George Petrosky's passed away now. He was Jason. And then the Russian Brute. He was the Russian Brute. he'd already been trained, but he never had any opportunities, so I gave it to him. Another guy that I did not train, I won't take any.
Well, and one of the differences probably, right? Like, especially with Wojo. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you there. Well, say one of the differences with Wojo might be attitude, right? And whatever Wojo set out to do, he was going to do it to the best of his ability.
He understood what it was about. You see, what it's about is drawing money and doing things to excite the people. And like Bobo Brazil taught me early on, you don't get yourself over, you get the match over. You do things to get your opponent looking good as well. And I always enjoyed working with Bobo Brazil. And but Wojo, he was my pride and joy of all the guys that I trained, of course. And he had a chance to study under other guys as well, and I was encouraging it, but he didn't want to. Al Costello, the Kangaroo, had a school in Detroit with Ricky Cortez, and I drew Wojo up there once, and Wojo just didn't want to take the ride. He says, you can teach me stuff. I said, I can teach you stuff, but it's good to learn from different guys. But he didn't want to go, which was his choice, And I had Al Costello, of blessed memory, who I loved the guy, but he turned on me a little bit, saying I was trying to keep Wojo all to myself. And I was doing exactly the opposite. I was begging him to go into Costello school because Al offered him to go for nothing. He would train him for nothing. And Ricky Cortez was a top-notch worker, was Al's partner. So to work out with those two guys would have been nothing but to help him. But Wojo moved right along, and guys like Don Kent, and after he got into the business, would show him stuff. And we were always willing to, I never tried to keep Wojo for myself, so to speak. It sounds like a lover's triangle, but I always wanted Wojo to get out there. And he became, I'll tell you the thing about Wojo that he became, he was a good mechanic, but his real strong point was he was believable.
Yeah, right.
Nobody doubted Wojo. When he took on the audience, people in the audience had a chance to come up and get a chance at the championship. And then we knew there wasn't going to be a response to this, but we had a millionaire that was a big fan put up $100,000 to Flair, Mark Winkle, and Hogan if they would wrestle Wojo belt for belt. He'd give him $100,000 if he could beat Wojo. We never had any takers.
Yeah. So. Well, and part of that believability, right, was the one of the things that he's known for is the $10,000 challenges, right, where the guys would come out and challenge Wojo. Tell us about those, because so many people think those kind of things are plants, works. Not they weren't with Wojo, right?
Those were absolutely guys out of the audience. We made them bring a doctor slip in saying they were fit to wrestle. We put that in our files along with a release that if anything happened, they weren't responsible. In some states like Ohio, we didn't need to do that because they have what they call an assumption of risk law. Like if you choose to jump out of a parachute, plane out of a parachute and the chute doesn't open, then you can't sue anybody because you assumed the risk. But we still covered ourselves with the outside of the thing we did with Terry Tyler. That was the only time that we had a thing. But everything else is absolutely 100% guys going for the $10,000, and nobody ever made it.
That's right. Nobody collected.
let me tell you a funny story. It was in Cleveland, Ohio, and a guy named, I think his name was Burns. If I got the last name wrong, I apologize, because this is back about 81, 82, when Wojo first turned pro. And he showed up in Cleveland to a Fred Curry promotion. And he was a national junior college heavyweight champion. Curry wasn't going to let him wrestle because he said, this isn't for other wrestlers. Like, if Curry was afraid that possibly this guy would be Wojo, and Wojo's face was turning red, his shaved bald head was turning red. He told Curry, just step back. He told Burns, I'm putting up the $10,000 out of my own pocket. But let me tell you something. You're a fellow amateur wrestler. And you come down here and try to make me look bad. I'm trying to feed my family with this. So you get up in that ring, and you just be ready for what happens to you, because I'm going to show – I try to protect these guys who don't know what they're doing because I don't want to hurt anybody. But you know what you're doing, and I'm coming – and the guy wouldn't get in the ring. He was afraid. He said, I didn't know it was a ring. I thought I was going to wrestle a mat. I don't wrestle in the ring. I don't know. He came with an excuse. Wojo was so mad that a fellow amateur would try to make him look bad.
Yeah.
We had another top-notch amateur show up in Indianapolis once, thanks to a wrestler named Stormy Gramzik. He's part of our promotion, so he brings the guy down he thinks can beat Wojo, which would screw us up, if we had to give up $10,000. So Wojo gave it to this guy pretty good. You had to pin Wojo to win. This guy Wojo didn't pin him, but they went to 5 minutes. Of all the matches he was in, of the challenge matches, there was a guy up in Michigan, I think it was Brighton, Michigan, but in that area, it wasn't Brighton, it was right in that area. They used to call him the Orange Crush, that was his nickname, and he had been an Olympic wrestler himself, and he was a big guy, over 6 foot tall, over 250 pounds, and he was a very accomplished amateur. And so we had this match, and the place was just jammed. And I mean, the place was just hysterical. They were all for the Orange Crush. You know, I was thinking when they were wrestling, if I'd have grabbed the Orange Crush's leg or something under the rope, I'd have been killed. I mean, the fans were all for the Orange Crush, And I told Wojo, I said, Wojo, I know this guy. He's really good. He didn't quite make the Olympic team, but he came close, and he's tough. I said, well, what you do is, I says, you get out there and you just wrestle defensively. It's 5 minutes. You know, in the wrestling matches, in the amateur matches, they're very big on stalling. But yeah. We never enforced that rule. And so what Wojo did was he just stalled. Wojo got a takedown, and the guy got an escape. So if it had been a score match, Wojo won 2-1. But also, yeah. Wojo was doing a lot of stalling and a lot of eating the clock up. But there were some great times. And, like I said, you've never seen anybody except Mildred Burke used to do it, and she used to beat the men, but that was another story.
Yeah.
Other than that, very few guys took challenges from the audience. Occasionally, I heard about it, but it wasn't as big a deal as when Wojo did it. He took it to another level.
You mentioned earlier, right, about Wojo's believability, right, and how no-nonsense a tough he was. And the reason that worked is because it was true, right? That was Wojo. But what was he like behind the scenes as a person, as a friend?
Well, as a friend, you make very few true friends in your life. One of the most misunderstood quotes is, a friend in need is a friend indeed. They always think that your friend is in need. But the point of that thing is that you're in need and somebody comes to you to help. That's a friend. Now, I was never really that much in need, but I'm saying Wojo would have been the one that would have been there. And I would have been. He was a great guy. He was the best friend I've ever had. I don't know if he can say the same about me, but I know that Wojo was 100% solid. He was a straight shooter, and he was a very humble guy. He wasn't a tough guy as far as acting. You know, he was tough. I mean, he wasn't a bully or anything like that. And I told a newspaper reporter from The Blade the other day, which I didn't get quoted, I thought it was a good quote. I said he was humble until the whistle blew in the amateurs and the bell rang in the pros, then he wasn't humble. Until the bell rang again or the whistle blew and it was over, then he was humble again. He was in the ring, he was a terror, but a nicer guy. I have not met, and I'm going to tell you this right now, one person anywhere that anything bad to say about Wojo. I mean, how many times? Of course, don't ever say anything bad about me behind my back. You can talk to
that. Sure.
He's backstabbing. But anyway, nobody ever said anything bad about Wojo. And I think it was a waste of talent. I have thoughts when I think wrestling a lot, maybe not so much now, but when I was in business, when something got thrown at me, I could immediately twist it into something that would work, I would think. And once again, I've said many a time, and Vince McMahon did very well without me. He did very well without Wojo. But I'm just saying, wouldn't it have been nice for him with the WCW to bring Wojo in, and then when you're going to go to a town to have a wrestling match, you're going to go to Baltimore, go to University of Baltimore, have Wojo come in early to have him work out with the wrestling team there. Then he beats their heavyweight, beats everybody there. And then he goes down to the matches that night, and then he loses to Hulk Hogan, let's say. Now, that would give what they call street cred. And you can always use a policeman if somebody's giving you a hard time or doesn't want to do a job. You put them in with Wojo, and they'll do the job, whether they like it or not. And Wojo would have been a tremendous asset. He didn't have to be the champ, although he makes a great champ. I'm saying with the big promotions, it's always good to have a guy like that around in your promotion. And Wojo would have been good because, like George Steele, he was a school teacher. He could have gone in for 3 months in the summer and worked at angles, what have you, and maybe on the weekends flown in and do some shows for them somewhere. But I made that presentation too, Vince. He didn't seem interested. I made it to Jim Barnett, and I was describing to Barnett what a tough guy, what a shooter Wojo was, all the championships he won. He says, I'm so impressed, which I think he wasn't impressed is what I think that asked. Well, I've had so many things I see. It just seems to be a perfect angle that they could be doing in a promotion, and they just don't see it. And the worst one for that, of course, was WCW, which was a wreck. when you think about WCW, I don't know if you ever thought about this before, or I don't know if you ever mentioned it before, but when they started, keep this in mind, they had way more money than Vince did. They had way more TV clearances than Vince did. And they had the same talent that they couldn't do anything with that Vince took over the world with. I mean, they had Roddy Piper, they had Paul Orndorff. You go right down the list. And all those guys, they all came to work for Vince, the same guys. So it's just a matter of the angles and how you use them. And when they first went WCW versus the Monday Night Wars, they called it, I'm sure you know they started off with WCW getting the better ratings.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, I don't want to embarrass him, but he's a pretty good wrestling guy, says, you guys are going to put Vince out of business. And he says, no, they're not. And in a few months, Vince is going to have it controlled. And that's what happened. And he says, this friend of mine says, why did that happen? You predicted it. What did you see? He says, what I saw was no intelligence, no programming, no what's coming next. They just have matches and they have run-ins and double disqualifications. Where Vince knew how to tell a story, how to keep it running. That's what I used to do at Bruiser Bedlam. It's like a soap opera. You got to keep people interested in the show. You got to get them to like the characters. And you can't just have run-ins, double disqualifications. I've seen so many of the territories going down the drain with that because nobody wanted to lose. And when I was booking Bruiser Bedlam, I did as many jobs as anybody else because losing does not hurt you. I mean, if you're a wrestler out there and you're saying, I'm not going to put this guy over, put that guy over. Now, yes, if you get beat all the time, that will bring down your credibility. But if you study the records, some of the biggest houses Muhammad Ali ever drew was after somebody beat him. And they had a return match. Whether it was Leon Spinks, whether it was Joe Frazier, whether it was anyone, if somebody beat Ken Norton, if somebody would beat Ali, a return match would be through the roof for sales. So I'm saying, like, you think a superstar like Hulk Hogan, if somebody were to beat him, just clean in the middle of the ring, no fancy deals or things, the return match would have been tremendous. The Hogan could have taken the belt back and they could have kept on going. But these wrestlers, I've seen so many of them get it in their head that I can't lose, I'll be done. If I get beat, don't get beat on television. I mean, come on. This is, the fans. Yeah, man, I was watching, I told the story before, probably told on your show as well. Vic the Bruiser was going to wrestle the Sheik in Toledo. They announced it the week before, and all the fans were yelling, double disqualification, double count out. And sure enough, they had I forget what it was, one of those things where nobody wins. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember wrestling in Rip Hawk?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, I was watching the match with Rip Hawk, and he was a very sharp booker in the Carolinas at one time.
He was
from Toledo. Toledo was his hometown. But he told me, he says, Jerry, just imagine the same match with the Sheik and the Bruiser. If the Bruiser were to pin the Sheik in the middle of the ring, and this is a raising of Bruiser's hand, the Sheik hits him with a ball of fire, how much heat would there have been? I said, I couldn't have imagined. You know, but these guys are all afraid to get beat. I'm telling you, an occasional, I'm not saying getting beat all the time, but an occasional loss does not hurt your cred. It won't hurt your drawing ability.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lose this guy, lose that guy. I understand Roddy Piper had his contract. He didn't have to lose to anybody. Well, you know what happened? He never got a belt, did he? I mean, Roddy was a good guy. Roddy was always nice to me. I like Roddy Piper. But I'm just saying, they couldn't put a belt on him because he's already got by contract. He can't lose.
Yeah.
So if he's not going to lose the belt, they can't give him one. And it doesn't hurt. Especially, look what I did with Steiner. Wojo put him over right in the middle of the ring. There was no fancy deals. I didn't slip him a blackjack or anything. Steiner just caught him and pinned him. And we did big business with Wojo trying to get his belt back. And it was a storyline. We call it programs. Yeah.
Sure. Well, and then like you said, like you and before you, you know, a little bit, Dick the Bruiser, you could always lean on Wojo for those kind of things, right? Those big draws, right? Whether it was, you know, feuding with Bruiser, you know, being the WWA champion, putting over a young Scott Steiner, battling Leon Spinks in boxer versus wrestler matches, you could always depend on Wojo, lean on him for those big places that he would do the right thing. Did he relish and take pride in being in those positions?
Wojo got into professional wrestling, and he enjoyed it. He enjoyed working, okay, after found out what it was. But his motivation was the same as my motivation. I guess hanging around me did him a lot of good. He wanted to make money.
Exactly. There you go.
I was talking to a fellow wrestler the other day about my age, retired, and I says, you know, if somebody would offer me $10,000 a week, they say, every night you're going to get beat in 2 minutes. Well, for $10,000 a week, I'll get beat every night in 2 minutes. I don't care. That's the one.
Sure.
I learned it from Thunderbolt Patterson. It's all about the money. It's all about the money, he told me. He was right. Yep. Yeah. But and so Wojo was all about the money. I mean, Wojo wasn't – I don't think Wojo would have agreed to get beat every night in 2 minutes like I would have. But the thing is with Wojo, you have a guy who wouldn't give you any trouble. You build him up. You give him some wins. And then you got somebody that needs to put over it. You've got a guy that – when you beat Wojo, it meant something. And that's where he would have been very good. Like they took him down to Puerto Rico – Carlos Colon, and they put him in with Hugo Zavinovich, or I can't pronounce his name, but the guy was a so-so worker, but the first night in, they had him go a half-hour draw with Wojo. That's not how you... you got to take Bruiser Brody and have him do a half-hour draw in his first match? I mean, come on, Wojo was a fighter.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to get in with guys that... you got to book them properly. That happened a lot. His match he had with Vince and Cobo Hall in Detroit, they gave him a 300-pound guy that was a rookie. I don't blame the guy because he hadn't had any training. But you know, there's nothing Wojo can do. You can't just flop a 300-pound guy around. It's not going to work with you. And it was a bad match, but and they put Wojo with somebody that could work. They could see him, but they didn't. And he could have been a real asset to any promotion he was with. I mean, was Alfred Lord Tennyson that said the saddest words of tongue or pen are these four words: it might have been. You know, it's too late now. Wojo's gone, and I'm 78, so there's no comebacks for me in the future either. So,
yeah, well, but like you spoke of, right? I mean, up until for 60 plus years, you and Wojo were very, very close, best fans. That speaks a lot about Wojo the man, correct?
Yeah, well, Wojo and me stayed friends after we both retired. We'd walk to lunch, take the wives out when my wife was living. We would do things together, and we were just friends. I mean, like I said, 63 years. And and he wanted to make money. That's all he wanted from wrestling. He liked being a star. He liked being the champion. But he said, you're going to drop the belt tonight. Okay. As long as it meant something. By meaning something, it means if it's going to be a star, it's going to help draw money. My last job as a booker is when I was ready to blow my brains out was powerbomb wrestling. I was getting older. I had the knowledge, but I didn't have the energy. I couldn't fight with these guys. They wouldn't do what I wanted them to do. They kept changing finishes behind my back. They would screw up everything. I'm thinking, I used to book some of the top guys in the business, Bobo Brazil, Moose Sholak. I think the Bruiser would listen to me. I was working with the Bruiser, but he liked my ideas. I mean, and nobody gave me a hard time. And I'd get these guys in that were... nothing, nobody's, never were nobody. And one guy was an Abdul the Butcher type of a guy. He was a big, big 350-pound guy, and he had an Arabic-type gimmick. And he's hitting a guy and standing there and watching him. And I says to him after the match, I says, you know, I like what I'm seeing, but what I like to see you do is stay on him more. Hit him, and when he moves, don't just stand there. Follow him around. I says, watch Abdullah the Butcher on the tape. Watch Abdullah the Butcher matches because you got similar gimmick. Just follow him around, and when you get, then you got to just come back, you sell him. But I mean, just, he says, nobody tells me how to work, go after yourself, and he quit. I was wrestling as a youngster, and an old pro came up to me and gave me some advice. I was so grateful. I was so grateful that the guy would take the time to show me something. These guys today, we had a couple guys, like, I'm not knocking, putting names out there because I don't want to get anybody mad at me for no reason at this point, but these guys were both sensational as far as mechanics is concerned. They were aerial men. They could do all kinds of stuff, high spots, and they would sit there in the arena and would be quiet. And I would tell these guys, you know, I can help you guys. Blah, blah, blah. I'd give them a high spot to start the match with, and the crowd would come up. Then they would go down and just be quiet. So one time they had an Iron Man match, just a half hour, not an hour. Big shows, a huge hour. And they said that they did some spectacular stuff, but there was no response from the crowd or very little. So I said, it's okay, you win. What did we do wrong? They said, well, what you did wrong is you're doing good things, but you're not doing it in the right place. Some use wrestlers use the expression, you got to tell a story. Sometimes you got to paint a picture. But the match has got to mean something. And Wojo understood that. Wojo understood when Wojo and me would work as tag team partners, he would pick up on the stuff that we were doing right away. And I just couldn't believe it when these guys, and they weren't drawing any money, and they wouldn't do a thing, except the time I made my comeback when I was 60 years old. Then the place was packed. And then when I brought my insane brother, Fabian Aloysius Graham, that beat my attendance record. But then after that, the guys in the ring, it was the same thing. They all were good mechanics, but they didn't know how to structure a match. And they didn't want to learn. You learn by having somebody like me tell you, teach you, suggest. And I would be happy to help anybody in this business, but they don't appreciate it. So I resigned from Powerbomb Wrestling. I didn't just walk out. I don't have female hormones. I went to the owners and said, I don't want to do this anymore. And I said, here's one last thing for you guys to do on your next show. And so I didn't leave them without a thing, is get somebody else to do the booking, because I can't do this. They're not going to. One time I booked a match, and I'm driving to Detroit to go on vacation. And they called me and says, oh, those guys told us they weren't going to be here that week, and we forgot. So they're advertised main event. I mean, this is what I had to put up with. I mean, once again, I'm not mentioning any names, because some of these guys that do these things are my friends. I sent some of my friends, but I'm not going to make it straight. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes too, but I am a perfectionist, and my definition is I strive for perfection. I'm never happy. I've never been there, but I want things to be done right. I want angles to be done right. I want things to be done right. And with Bruiser Bedlam, we had a great success with my ideas. Of course, at that time, we were booking 20 shows a month, and a guy would get fired from there. And I only fired two guys the whole time I was there at Bruiser Bedlam. And both times, one guy was a friend of mine. I didn't want to do it, but he went to work for a competition of ours right in Toledo area. And I told him, I said, you can't do that. You're on my TV. And they do that, and everybody on our TV can go work for anybody they want to. And those guys should have called me and said, we want to run a show, and I would have worked with them. But they just tried to pirate my help. And the one guy that won, I had to fire him, and he was a good friend of mine. Another guy was a dope addict, kept coming in high, and when he had a bad match with El Bracero, which was almost impossible to have, El Bracero was one. So that's when I let him go. I said, okay, if you can't have a good match with El Bracero, we can't use you because a broomstick could have a good match with El Bracero.
If somebody came up to you and asked you to summarize the great Wojo, just as a pro wrestler, not the person, just as a pro wrestler, what would you tell them?
You mean critique him? Does somebody mean critique
him? Yeah, no, if they just said, tell me about I've never seen the great Wojo. Okay. I've never seen his career. Tell me what the great Wojo was like.
Well, you got a guy that's 5'10", 285 pounds without an inch of fat on him. A guy that had a head for the business, a guy that had the right attitude for the business, a guy that would work with people. He would never hurt anybody, although if there was anybody that was capable of hurting somebody, it was the great Wojo. Somebody trying to shoot with him, they would have been extremely sorry. But he had the right attitude. He never hurt anybody. He never lost his temper in the ring. Like if you get potatoed or something, he was just absolutely. He would be an asset to any promotion that he was with. And I don't know why more guys didn't pick him up. People tell me that all the time. Why didn't Mojo go with the big guys? I tried to get him in with Vince. Ric Flair booked him with WCW. I think I told you that story. Mm-hmm. And Mojo's had his car packed ready to drive to Atlanta. And just some instinct, he said, some premonition, he called down there and says, Mojo, I'm starting there this week. And should I come right to Atlanta? Do you want me to go to a town? He had a question. He said, we don't know what you're talking about. You're not scheduled down here. So why Ric Flair would do that? Ric Flair, one of my nemesises, he was a very rude person, a very, he's still going around. He doesn't realize he's pushing 80 like I am. And, it's time to be the grand old man and just sit down and shake hands. And I'm not saying he's not come to the matches. They're going to induct Mojo into the CIW Hall of Fame on September the 14th here in Toledo. And I know I don't go to these little shows anymore. They asked me to come to that one to be there and help accept the award with us. I believe they're going to give it to us. I told him I would be there for this one.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were, like I said, it was a big devastation to me when they called me. Mm-hmm. And told me I was. I've always tried to deal with death in a realistic manner, knowing that everybody's going to die. And I've always been, a very stoic type person. I've been dying on the inside. But I just broke down when I heard Wojo. I just...
Yeah, just, of course.
It was just too much. Wojo was a man that should have had a chance, never did. If he had come out of the school, and once again, if is a big word. They say if wishes were horses, beggars could ride. But if he would have been come out of the same era as Lou Thesz and Strangler Lewis and guys like that, he would have fit right in because. Yep. That's the way he was. He was tough, rough, and ready to go. And but he still had a career, and he enjoyed himself. And and he had his family and his wife.
That's what I was gonna say. Now, say Jerry, someone else approaches you, and says, "I don't care about professional wrestling. Whatever. I don't care. Tell me about Greg, as a husband, a father, a man, a friend." What would you say to that person?
His family came first. Believe me, I'll tell you. I already told you about as a friend. He was a guy who would be there for you if you needed him.
Yes.
At least for me, he would. And he took care of his kids. He trained them. He made sure they did good at schoolwork. One of his sons is an anesthesiologist. Mm. The other one is a wrestling coach at a high school. And and his wife is a wonderful woman, Hilda, and he has stepkids and grandkids and step-grandkids, and he's absolutely a family man from the heart. I mean, he was like the Ozzie Nelson of wrestling.
You
don't remember Ozzie Nelson.
Yeah, I do. No, I remember him,
Cleaver. I mean, he was a father. Yeah. He was absolutely... he was a sitcom father, a 50s sitcom father.
Yeah.
Sit down and help. He could help Chip with his homework and he'd get an A with just one session.
Yeah.
That's the kind of a guy he was. He was he was too good to be true. Too good to be true. Unlike most wrestlers, including me, he was too good to be true. But that's the way he was.
Yeah, well, and like you said, right, Jeremy, anybody who's involved in wrestling, right, you lost many friends in the business and everything else. But you, like you said, this was different for you, right? Because this wasn't just a friend. This, like you said, 60-plus years. Yeah. This wasn't a friend. This was a brother.
And I knew his father. I knew his mother. I knew his grandmother.
Yeah.
I got a picture of Greg when he was in grade school that I keep on my desk drawer here.
Yeah.
It was a friendship. Remember one time his father came in a restaurant with his mother, which would be Greg's grandmother, and they saw us, they sat down with us, and he says to his mother, he says, "This is Jerry, he wrestles with Greg." And she says, "You better not hurt my grandson." I'll try to control myself, but sometimes when I get mad, I might have to break an arm or leg or something. His dad was
laughing. Those wrestling grandmothers. That's right.
Son. I don't think she has to worry about Dr. Graham hurting or anybody else.
That's right. That's right. Well, and I wanted to ask you as we wind this down, and if you don't want to share, I understand. Do you recall the last time you spoke to Wojo?
Yeah, it was about a week or two ago. I congratulated him for getting put in the Amateur Wrestling Hall of Fame. I couldn't go with him, but I just couldn't make the trip. It was too far. And we were talking about going to get together and have lunch. And that was kind of an innocuous conversation. And then I got a call and he died.
A conversation you've had, probably thousands of times, right?
Maybe a week. Maybe a week before he died, a week, 10 days, something like that. We'd call each other just to see how we're doing sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to close, Jerry, with this, though. If you've had that conversation with Wojo a thousand times, talked to him, right, about this and that, let's have lunch, blah, blah, blah. You've done that so many times. But if you had the chance to do that last conversation again, and you knew that was the last conversation, what would you say to Greg Wojo?
Well, I'm going to have to say I don't know. That's like saying if you were going to be put in the electric chair, what would you say before you threw the switch? You'd have to be sitting there. I don't know. That's just the question. I'm not trying to be rude.
It's a deep question, right? It's heavy.
If somebody's going to die tomorrow, what are you going to say to them?
But I venture to guess, as close to, as you and Greg were, I think you probably didn't leave a lot unsaid between each other, right, over the years. I think if there was something to be said.
We know each other as well. He was like a brother to me. His kids are like nephews to me.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, his older boy, Chad, the wrestling coach, I says, I was talking to him the other day, and he's very distraught, as he should be. His father died.
Sure.
And I tried to cheer him up a little bit. I said, you've got a new job. He says, "What's that?" I said, "Well, for 63 years, your dad protected me if anybody would pick on me." Because he's a big guy just like his dad.
You've inherited that.
you're gonna have to protect me now if anybody picks on me anymore. So he says, "Don't worry, Doc. I got your back."
I think that probably summarizes Wojo the best, right? He had your back, right? He was that kind of friend you could count on. And all of us, right, that watched him, there's things that we can think of as fans, and we miss him as fans and everything else. But again, that's why I wanted to talk to you, Jerry, because it's different. It's a whole new level. You worked with him, right, whatever. But it was different for you, a whole new level this was, forget the wrestling, whatever. This was your best friend, like you said, a guy you knew for 60-plus years. That's special. That's different.
Absolutely.
And again, I'm sorry for your loss, Jerry, right? Because I know you and him, how close you were. I talked to Wojo. He told me how close you guys were. He told me how much himself, how much you meant to him when I talked to him. And I know, right? I've talked to you so many times. I know the relationship you guys had. I know how close you were. I know it was more than whatever, quote unquote, co-workers, whatever. It was not a business thing. You guys were family. And I'm sorry, I'm sorry for your loss. I'm sorry for Wojo was a great man. I'm sorry for everybody's loss. He's one of a kind. And I know it was tough for you, Jerry. And I'm glad you gave me some time. I know it's still fresh, still new, but I'm glad you came on and talked to me so that the world could hear from you.
It's a tribute to Wojo. It is. I'm happy. I'm not happy, but I'm proud would be a better word. I'm proud to do it. I'm proud to talk about my friend. Like I said, I appreciate the fact that you took the time to put all the stuff on the internet that you did. And Did you catch the clip we posted on Channel 11? They did a really good piece on.
I did. I shared that. I saw you on there, on there, and everything else. I shared that, and there's been several things out there, and it's great to see. It's great to see this guy. And I'm glad. Right, Wojo got he got some of his honors while he was alive, and I'm glad of that. But I hope he knew how much he was appreciated, and how much people appreciated what he did and who he was.
Well, I think you're right, and I think people did appreciate him, and
definitely.
I think that once again, he was one of a kind, and my life is a little less joyful without him.
Welcome to Graham's Gallery, a neutral and professional television journalistic piece featuring the greatest professional wrestlers in the world today. In the past weeks, we've had some good wrestlers. In the past weeks, we've had some great wrestlers. But today, it's my honor, my distinguished pride. I'm just so happy to have the heavyweight champion of the world, the WWE champion, the great Wojo. Wojo, welcome to Graham's Gallery.
Thanks. It's really great to be on a first-class show like this.
Well, Wojo, you know, you are a legend. I mean, you are one of the few Americans to be in the Russian Hall of Fame of wrestling for your amateur accomplishments. You were the only person, I believe, ever to make the heavyweight slot as an alternate in the Olympic team while you were still a senior in high school. I mean, you were a 13-time national AAU champion. You were on four Olympic teams. You were a three Pan American Times champion. You were so many times you've toured the world. You've toured Russia. You've toured Mexico. You've been to the Canary Islands, South America. You have amateur titles longer than anybody's arm. It's amazing. And then you've turned professional, and yet, I've been going over your record. I noticed where you had a lot of wins early in your career. In fact, all wins. You didn't seem to be in the top slots. You didn't seem to be making the big money. I'm sure a lot of fans want to know, was there any certain point in your career when you began to be a real success as a wrestler, became a top contender, and eventually the WWA champion?
Well, you're absolutely right. 2 years after being United States Olympic champion, I was undefeated. I think I had about 100 professional fights. Never, not one main event. And I wasn't going anywhere. Instead of wrestling on the weekends, I was loading trucks on the dock. And that's when you came into my life, and you turned it all around. You got me the best matches, and eventually now I'm champion, world champion.
In other words, you owe it all to Dr. Graham.
Oh, absolutely. I was about ready to retire. That's all there was to it until the doctor came into my life.
Now, let me ask you this, Wojo. You are probably the only wrestler in the world today that tours the country in states where the commission allows it, and you actually accept challenges from the audience. You tell anybody, if there's anybody out here, any college wrestlers, any high school wrestlers, any other professional wrestlers, any tough men, football players, anybody that wants to step in the ring with you, you have a special challenge match where if they can pin you in 5 minutes, you give them $10,000. Would you care to elaborate on this?
That's absolutely right. It's thanks to the confidence that you have in me and thanks to the $10,000 you put up for me. I'll take on any human being in the world, and if they can pin me in 5 minutes, they'll get $10,000.
Now, a lot of wrestling fans come up to me, Wojo, and they say, you know, Dr. Graham, we watch this wrestling program, we watch that wrestling program. Everywhere we go, there seems to be somebody claiming to be the world heavyweight champion. We watch this cable station, we watch this local channel. Why do you claim to be the heavyweight champion? Now, what credentials do you have that maybe somebody else doesn't have?
Well, let me tell you something. First of all, I was the United States Olympic champion in 1980. I beat, in the past, all the 1984 Olympic champions, and I've beaten all the professional champions, or all the professional wrestlers that I've wrestled.
Right.
It's the only thing I can criticize you for as my manager, that you've been unable to get me a match with the
champion. Well, Wojo, to defend myself, it's common knowledge to every champion anywhere from any wrestling promotion that I have a certified check posted for $100,000 to anybody that claims to be the world champion that wants to match you belt for belt to make an undisputed title unification, and they've all run like cowards. Every heavyweight champion, I believe there's about three other men claiming to be world champion, are like whipped puppies. They go to their promoters in New York City. They go to their promoters in Atlanta, Georgia, and they say, oh, Dr. Graham's put up $100,000. The letters and cards are coming in. You're humiliating me. Don't make me wrestle Wojo. They beg them. They say, please, please don't wrestle Wojo. I want to be champion. I'll be champion of this. I'll be champion of that. But don't make me face Wojo for the belt because he'll beat me $100,000. Not one of them have ever made $100,000, and they've all turned and run and been humiliated.
Today I'm joined by a very special guest, a man who I could literally rattle off for an hour, given all of his credentials to introduce him. But we'll just say he's a former Olympian and a former three-time WWA champion, the great Wojo. Wojo, how are you today?
Hey, doing good. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you coming on. You have truly been
one of the guests that my listeners most wanted to have on the show. I'm kind of targeted toward those Midwest guys, so WWE and stuff, and they always want to hear from Wojo. So I'm very happy to have you on. So let's talk a little. We'll go over some of your amateur stuff. I mean, you could talk for a week on your amateur credentials, but let's just for the listener's sake, let's go over a few things here. And correct me any of this information if I'm wrong on any of it. I have that, I have down that you were in 67 to 68 a state high school champion in Ohio. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Whitmer High School in Toledo.
Okay. And then your senior year, you were an alternate for the Olympic team. Is that right?
Yep. Well, right after I graduated, I was second in the Olympic tryouts. Made it to the camp, and I lost by 1 point to make the team.
Yeah. So what's that like, being that young? That had to be kind of unusual, right? I mean, to be that young?
Oh, yeah. That's probably I was the youngest, definitely the youngest there. I think that one person's made the team maybe slightly younger than me. But yeah, that was unusual. I was I had good coaching, good early training, and it was a good year.
Yeah. And then you went to the University of Toledo. You went there in 69, and then your sophomore year you finished second place in the national for the national title, correct?
Yes.
And then in 71, excuse me, you actually won the NCAA heavyweight championship.
Yeah. Yeah, I beat Dave Joyner from Penn State. I think it's 5-3 in the finals.
Yeah. So what was that? I mean, what was that like, knowing that, you know, at that point, at that level, you'd reached the pinnacle there. Outside the Olympics, obviously. But so, tell us what you were feeling. What was going on in your mind winning that national title?
That's my goal. I mean, that was my goal, to be an NCAA champion and make the Olympian. So that achieved one of my major goals, you know, right there.
Yeah. And then your senior year, you finished second again. And you finished to a name that a lot of pro wrestling fans might know. You finished second to Chris Taylor, right?
Yeah, Chris Taylor is second in NCAA, second in the Olympic tryout and freestyle, and second in Greco to him, too.
Yeah, which,
he's,
I mean,
460 pounds.
Yeah.
460 pounds from Iowa State.
Yeah, I'd have to say it might be worth noting the weight disadvantage you were probably at against Taylor. Have you wrestled anyone at that size at that point in your career?
No, he was the biggest.
I bet
he was the biggest, man.
So,
I had a few guys 320, and I could beat them, but Taylor was just so big that couldn't do much with him.
Yeah. So let's go off on a little tangent here for a moment. Taylor, he had a brief flirtation with the pro ranks with Vern Gagne and the AWA. Did you see any of his brief pro career when he was with Vern? And what did you think of it?
No, I never saw him. Never saw him wrestle pro.
Yeah, there wasn't much to see. See, it didn't translate over real well for him. I have that you won three straight MAC heavyweight titles. Is that your conference? I'm assuming that's the conference Toledo was in,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Mid-American Conference. Yeah.
Yeah.
And freshmen weren't eligible back then, so.
Okay. What?
Yeah.
Something else. So now I heard a rumor. Okay, you graduated in 72. I heard a rumor that you almost turned pro in 72. Is that true?
If I'd have made the Olympic team, I would have. In 1970, I won the National AAU Freestyle in Tampa, Florida. Mm-hmm. And Bob Roop was there. He's the one that beat me in the 68 Olympic tryouts, by the way.
Okay.
Babyface Bob Roop, professional wrestling fans ought to remember him.
Yeah.
But he introduced me to Eddie Graham, who is the big promoter down there.
Yeah, down Florida.
And Eddie Graham sent me his card, said, when you're ready, give me a call. And I was all set. He said, I'd like to have you. When you're ready, give me a call. And I wanted to make the Olympic team, and then I was going to give him a call.
Okay, so making the Olympic team, that caused you to refocus then on making the team in 4 years and putting the pro ranks off for a bit then. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I was determined to make the Olympic team.
Yeah. So, it's kind of odd to think what it would have been like if you went to Florida. I mean, and especially in 72, I mean, Florida, that was Eddie Graham as a hotbed and what, it, you know,
yeah.
So
it's a nice territory. I mean, Roop is doing well.
Yeah.
Eddie Graham liked the former amateur wrestlers and he was babyface Bob Roop down there.
Yeah.
He was doing real well. And like I say, he introduced me to him. He said it's a good, he liked it. He liked it down there. He liked the territory. So he said, finish your college education first. So,
sure.
He recommended that, but Roop is he was good to me.
Yeah. So are you, Bob Roop, were you close, given your all the tie-ins you had in the amateur days? I mean, did you get to know each other pretty well?
Yeah, pretty well, because we were at the Olympic camp. I was at the Olympic camp training with him in 1968. And we wrestled a few times after. I beat him a few times after that. But then he turned pro.
Yeah. So have you stayed in touch at all over the years? Or?
No, we haven't stayed. We haven't kept in touch. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then
Jim Raschke and I keep in touch. I remember Baron Fritz von Raschke.
Oh, you do? Yeah, you still keep in touch?
Yeah, he was an outstanding amateur wrestler, too. So he
was.
Silver medalist and world championships in Greco-Roman.
Yeah. Yeah, what year was that with Raschke? Do you know what year?
Raschke and I were just friends. When he was in Toledo at the world championships in 66, uh-huh. I was just in high school, but I went over and worked out with him.
Gotcha.
So I got to know him that way. I worked out with him, and then I got to know him that way.
Yeah, stayed in touch, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, so we're in the ring together in a battle royal in Fort Wayne. I didn't see him for about 10 years, and got a chance to talk to him a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys, I mean, he wrestled in Indianapolis for a long time, but you guys probably just missed each other by several years there when you came in pro there in Indy.
Yeah, I was about 2 years too young. He should have, if he'd have stayed with it, if he turned pro at 66, I think, after that, he'd have probably made the Olympic team in Greco-Roman in 68 if he had stayed with it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, your determination paid off, because in 1980, you did make the Olympic team. And tell me now, there you are. That was it had to have been your next goal, right? You won the national title in college, and your next goal, you said, was to make the Olympics. So what was that feeling when you made the team there in 80?
Tremendous sense of relief. I almost made it 68, 72. I almost made it. I got cheated, politically cheated in 72 because they let Chris Taylor go both styles.
Yeah,
freestyle and Greco-Roman. They never let anybody do that before. Usually you'd get your choice.
Right.
The other guy goes usually Greco.
Yeah, Jerry Graham told me that story. Tell everybody what you mean by that. Tell what that means to people that aren't familiar with amateur. And when you say Greco-Roman and freestyle, can you kind of just give a high-level explanation of that for people?
Well, there's two styles in freestyle. Freestyle, you can, it's more like our high school and college style. You can attack legs. Where Greco-Roman is all upper body. You can't do any trips or anything below the waist, so you can see a lot of throws.
Yeah.
A lot of throws in Greco-Roman wrestling is all, upper body.
Yeah. So prior to that.
Normally the Americans did better in freestyle, so normally the guy, very seldom did get both guys win both, freestyle and Greco-Roman. But Taylor did it, and then they had a special vote in the Olympic Committee. Had a special vote that Greco-Roman coach pushed, so they let him do both styles if he made it. And he had to be dominant. But we tied, we had three ties in the Greco in the final camp, three ties, and then finally he beat me. And they let him do both styles. They see politically I was bitter, kind of Carter boycotted the Olympics in 1980. But I was more bitter about that Olympic Committee decision in 72.
Yeah. So, yeah, like you said, they boycotted the Olympics there in the 80. Did you feel a little cheated, though? I mean, you worked so hard to get to this level and then not to – I mean, you didn't get to – did it take – you said you had a sense of relief, but did it almost like – here you did it, now you got your legs kicked out from under you?
Yeah, I was relieved to make the team. I finally made the team. I had mixed feelings. They did a nice 4-day celebration in Washington. Mm-hmm. Congress gave me a gold medal. Jimmy Carter, I got to meet the president and his wife. Gold medal. They did it up real nice. The Olympic Committee did it nice. But it'd have been nice to go to Moscow.
Yeah.
Actually step on the mat. Actually walk through that parade. I'd like to have been in that parade.
Yeah. Now when I talked to Dr. Jerry Graham Jr., He tells me that going into those 80 Olympics, in his mind, at the very least, you had a very realistic chance of getting bronze. How did you feel?
That was a good bronze. I can never beat the Russian.
Yeah.
I beat the Pole, I believe, came in third. I beat him in a practice match once at a training camp. Mm-hmm. I beat the guy that was fourth. So I think bronze would have been realistic.
And so I was kind of wrap up the amateur. Did you attempt to make the teams anymore after that in 84, 88? Did you go out for the teams anymore? No, that was it.
No, I turned pro after that. Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Okay. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
You trained with Dr. Jerry Graham Jr., Dick the Bruiser, there. where you knew Jerry from high school. Is that correct?
Oh, Jerry, yeah. Before that, even grade school. We're together in Hawaii. They used to have a Hawaii kids, downtown Hawaii kids program. So we met kids program at Hawaii.
Yeah, so you knew Jerry all these years, and you told, you know, he was already, you know, managing in the pros and wrestling for Bruiser. So did you make the call to them about going pro? Did they call you after the boycott? How did that all turn about?
Well, I talked to Jerry, and I think it was around 1976. I said, if I make the Olympic team, will you be able to hook me up and get me started wrestling professional? Okay. And it was at the Toriel Health Club.
Sure.
And he said, yeah, he'd do his best to help me get started. But I didn't make the team in 76, so then I had to wait till 1980.
Okay.
Then Jerry's working out at Toriel's. I said, let's get going.
Okay.
So he helped me out. He trained me.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time you met Dick the Bruiser?
Yep. Yeah, I was in Indianapolis doing TV promotions. Yeah.
Okay, so after Jerry had already trained you, and Bruiser brought you in, so that's the first time you met him. Was when you were working, right?
Yeah, just starting out.
Yeah.
Bruiser gave me, Jerry trained me, but Bruiser gave me the opportunity.
Sure. Now, what was your initial impression on Bruiser? Because I would like to think you and him have a lot, you know, you get along pretty well. You're pretty no-nonsense, pretty focused. You know, he has, you know, played college football briefly and everything else. So what was your, yeah. how did you get along with Bruiser initially? And what was your first impressions?
Oh, I was impressed. I was impressed with him. And I knew he was older, but he's a well-built guy. He was rugged. He's a rugged guy, and he was always down to earth, and he treated me fairly too. So.
Yeah. Do you remember your debut match at all, pro? Or is it?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Who was that against?
In Toledo, I beat Smasher Stone.
Oh, okay.
The body slam.
Yeah.
It was a thrill. It was thrilling. It was exciting.
Yeah. And from what Jerry tells me, you didn't necessarily watch a lot of pro wrestling growing up or anything like that. You weren't a big fan like he was. But it was just the natural progression to your career.
Yeah, we watched a little bit here and there, but not too much.
Yeah.
I remember Killer Kowalski though and Bobo Brazil a little bit, but I wasn't a big fan. But yeah. I always say I had the goal. I wanted to make the Olympic team and then wrestle pro though. I always had the goal.
Okay. And then so you start wrestling for Bruiser there. What was it soon after? 80, 81? I mean the early 80s, right? I mean it wasn't
soon after I made the Olympic team. I came back from the Washington ceremonies and I think I started in August. I got started in September.
Yeah, and were
then Bruiser probably didn't work for Bruiser until maybe November of that year, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay. And during this time, were you, because you have a teaching degree, correct? Were you still teaching and stuff during all this?
Oh yeah. I taught full time all the time. I wrestled professional just part time.
Yeah, and now
except in the summer, you know, I had a chance to go to Japan for a while and Puerto Rico.
Right.
You know, it's what's good about being a teacher, you get summer vacation.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another rumor that I'd always heard about your career, and this is back with Vern Gagne here. I heard that early when you started your pro, that Vern tried to talk you into taking a year off from teaching and coming up and working from him. Is there any truth for that?
No, that's not true.
That's not true.
I think you know, if I would have wanted to move and, you know, live there, he'd have gave me an opportunity. He was friends with my coach and mentor, Dick Toriel. The guy at Toriel Health Club, I grew up in his gym.
Yeah.
So they were friends. Toriel could have hooked me up with Vern Gagne. And Vern liked amateur wrestlers too. So.
Yeah, that's what everybody says. Everybody says that you seem to be the perfect guy that Vern Gagne would be go hot and heavy for. You had that amateur background and you're no nonsense. And everybody cannot believe that you didn't work more extensively for Vern. I think you probably did some shots for him in Chicago. I believe I've seen. But Vern never really, give a hard pursuit on you or anything, or?
No, not really, no. Never got a hot pursuit.
Yeah. So a lot of people wonder how come you didn't do more nationally. And Jerry's always said it's because you wanted to stick close to home. You wanted to continue to teach and coach and do those things. And you just didn't have the desire to do the travel. Is that pretty accurate?
Well, yeah, I had three sons. By the time I made the Olympic team, I had three sons. I had a mortgage, 30-year mortgage, and I was 10 years in or 9 years into a teaching career. So I was pretty well homebound. And then midway through it, I was starting to get better as a professional wrestler. I got divorced, and I had custody of my sons. So that really tied me down. That limited my professional career big time.
Yeah, it changes your priorities. I mean, you got bigger responsibilities than just yourself. So, another side question, and you may not know anything about it, but around 1982, late in 1982, Dick the Bruiser worked with Jerry Jarrett, did some co-promoting with Memphis, and they ran some shows in Indiana and things. And I've seen a few of these results, and you're not on any of those shows. Were you not used in any of those shows that they kind of co-promoted with Jerry Jarrett?
You say 1982?
82. It was in November of 82.
Yeah, I don't think I was in. I don't think I was in any of those.
Yeah, it was just it was just a few shows. A couple in Fort Wayne. They had a falling out pretty quick. But it's always fascinating to talk about that. It's a weird little bookmark in Bruiser history there, where he worked with Jerry Jarrett for a while there. But so you're wrestling for Bruiser and everything else. In 1984, you won your first WWA title, and you won it from Stormy Granzig. And that's not a very common name. A lot of people wouldn't know. What are your memories of Stormy Granzig?
Oh, he's well built. He's athletic and a real well built guy. Real strong, well built. He was a good polished worker.
Yeah. So how did you feel when you found out you were getting the title? I mean, did you feel that sense of achievement? I mean, obviously it's not the same as your amateur achievements, but I mean, did you feel that little boost of confidence that Bruiser was giving you the title?
Oh yeah, it was. I thought it was a momentous occasion for me, big time. I thought it was gonna spring big time. I think I still had a possibility. I was still married at that time and stuff, so I wasn't locked down. So I thought it was gonna be a big opportunity for me.
Right. Okay. And then you've won the title three times. You traded it off. You lost it to Bruiser, and regained it from him in 85. But one of the things that when people think about the Great Wojo and your career, there's a lot of people in that same breath think of Scott Recksteiner and your matches with Scott, because obviously Scott Recksteiner became Scott Steiner. And so let's talk about Steiner for a minute. He came in 86. Did you have a hand in helping trade Scott?
Yeah, we trained him. Dr. Graham and I, we trained him. We trained him at Torrio Health Club. And I first met him at the Michigan. He wrestled for Michigan. He was a Big Ten champ.
Sure.
He and his brother, they both were at University of Michigan wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And I used to coach there at the camp. They hired me about 2-3 weeks in the summer to go teach at the wrestling camp in Michigan. So that's how I met both the Rex Steiners through the Michigan wrestling camp.
So what did you think of Scott Recksteiner? Obviously, you knew his background. You had a lot in common with him. Dr. Jerry Graham always says that, I mean, he's never seen someone pick it up so quickly. It was just like he was just a natural. What did you think when you were – go ahead.
He was a natural. We had great matches together because we both – we had the amateur background and we trusted each other, and we could put on some good matches.
Yeah, I mean,
he's talented. I mean, he could do flips off the rope, and he's well built, young kid, good looking young kid. He's perfect for the business.
Yeah, and you guys put him over like $1 million because in his debut match, he defeats you for the title. Whose idea was that? And I mean, kind of put the rocket ship on him and immediately get him to that top level.
Well, I got cheated on that one. I had him up in a backbreaker, and I thought he gave up. The referee, I thought it was over, and he caught me with a backslide. So
yeah,
that wasn't fair.
Yeah, maybe your manager should have been watching your back a little more. We'll have to talk to Dr. Jerry about that. I don't think he was there for you. So what do you think of Scott there early as a person? Because obviously there's all these wacky tales about Scott Steiner later, and and his persona and his attitude and everything else. What was he like when he was young?
Oh, he's a great athlete. I mean, he was a Big Ten champ. I think he's an All-American. he's a great athlete, and he learned good, and he's good to work with.
Yeah. Did everybody look at him and just think he had a big future ahead of him, and he was going to get there?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. You know, like any great professional athlete, you can see, you know, when they start out there, you can see he had all the God given assets. Sure. And he worked hard at it too.
Yeah. And then a lot of people, when they think you're pro career, another thing that comes to mind very quickly is the $10,000 challenge. Tell us about the $10,000 challenge and explain what that was and who came up with that idea.
Well, I think it's Dr. Graham and I both together came up with that idea. You know, we're trying to promote the fact that I could really wrestle, and especially when I got the belt, the championship belt, you know, I could protect the business by doing that. And they had to pin me in 10 minutes. If they pin me in 10 minutes, they get $1,000.
Okay.
And I think we upped it to $10,000 later on. But it was good for the business, and I had some good challenge matches.
Yeah.
Some around the best the Bruiser bet on, there's some on. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact,
yeah,
I guess I invented the knee choke, the knee to the throat that we see on the news all the time.
Yeah.
I just by instinct I did that. Some guy, he must know some martial arts or something. I had his leg, had him on his back, and he kicked me in the chest hard.
Yeah.
And he knocked me off, and he angered me, and I just by instinct I put my knee on his throat.
Yeah.
If you don't get out of the ring right now, I'm going to kill you. And it's one of them things I'm Bruiser Bedlam too.
Yeah. Now Jerry always said that it was playing right in your strengths, because in the amateur game a lot of times, you know, you can eat time, and that's kind of what you were good at that if need be. And so how did you go about picking the challengers from the crowd? I mean, did he try to find someone that he thought, you know, might put up a good fight, but, you know, not push you too far? Or, I mean, how did that all come about?
Well, we didn't pick him. Usually the promoter, whoever's promoting the matches or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Well, and they, you know, they'd ask people to sign, you know, sign up as they walk in or whatever. So we didn't hand select them. It was a real deal. There are a few ringers. I think Stormy Granzig was a little angry with me for winning the title from him, and he brought a buddy in that I didn't know he was a wrestler. He was a junior college national champion. He's a 190-pound national champion.
Yeah.
All roided up. He's about 250 pounds. I wasn't worried about it. I didn't know he could, I didn't think he could wrestle. I didn't know anything about his background. He came right in there. He picked me up with a double leg tackle, picked me way up in the air, slammed me down. And it took me about 30 seconds to be able to pop up and get away from him, get, you know, my amateur style escape.
Yeah.
I ended up taking him down about two times. He got exhausted, and I tripped him, did a cross leg foot sweep on him. He rolled out of the mat. He was exhausted, and he left. But he was a ringer.
Yeah.
And the Orange Crush up in Michigan, he was a coach. But I knew he was good going in. He was a coach up in Michigan at a high school. We did a booster benefit, and he gave me a good match. I beat him by it'd have been about a 2-point decision. It was in amateurs.
Yeah,
it was interesting.
That's, you know, that's something Jerry always said that he thought would have been a perfect role for you with a national company like WWE or whatever. Would have been at, you know, whatever town, you know, they were in or whatever else that you could go do appearances with the local high schools. And with the, you know, the wrestling team, given your amateur background and stuff, I'd have to think doing some of these boosters and stuff, you know, that would tie in well with given your amateur background.
Yeah, I think it'd been a good way if, you know, one of these big agencies would have picked me up.
Yeah.
But again, my lack of willingness to travel, I think it held me back. But that'd been a good way to go.
Yeah.
It drew interest. It drew interest. The challenge match drew some interest in the fans.
Yeah, of course. And a name from the Bruiser Bedlam days that a lot of people don't know a lot about is a guy named Terry Tyler. Who is Terry Tyler? Do you know much about him? Because no one knows much about him, and he didn't really appear much beyond those Bruiser Bedlam days. Do you know who he was or much about him?
I think he originally started out challenging me.
Oh, yeah?
He's a big guy. He come up there with the farmer bib overhauls and stuff.
Yeah.
Big guy, and he started out the challenge match. And it wasn't a setup or anything, and I beat him in the challenge. He was pretty tough. He was a big, strong guy. He was pretty tough. I beat him in the challenge match, and I think some promoters picked up on him.
Yeah. I wonder, I've never heard of him, but I don't wonder whatever happened to him, because beyond those, you know, a little bit there in Bruiser Bedlam, I never heard of Terry Tyler beyond that. So.
Yeah, he worked a little bit, maybe 4 or 5 matches here and there. He's a pretty good wrestler. I think he was home, you know, he had a good job. I don't know, from southeastern Michigan or something. But he might have been an auto worker or something. So,
yeah,
you know, a little reluctant to leave, do it full time.
Sure. Yeah. And then around 88, you were still the WWE champ, and you kind of retired from the, you know, backed off your schedule, gave up the title. What brought that about around that time? Were you just cutting back your schedule, or what happened there?
Oh, well, that was the family issues. That was, I think, 86 when I became a single father. So
okay,
I had son. My sons at that time were probably 6, 9, and 12. You know.
Yeah.
So okay. I just had to pick my shots carefully. I think I made the trip to Japan in between that time, about a 3-week period in Japan.
Yeah.
But I had to pick my shots carefully after that.
Well, when you went to Japan, who did you work for around that time? Who were you working for?
As the wing promotion.
Okay, right. Yeah. So what was that like? Because
I think
Japan
has some stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, they have completely different crowds over there.
Well, Japan, they mostly match me up. They match me up these young guys. I think they were trying to set up coming back to the challenge match thing. Mm-hmm. But that shoot wrestling was popular in Japan at the time. And these were pro workers, but they had me going with these young guys, karate guys and judo and some amateur wrestlers that wanted to be pros.
Mm-hmm.
And they had me working with them guys mostly. And then I did a few tag team matches and stuff. But it was a great trip. You know, I was there about 3 weeks. Hey, it was clean. The food was good. Conditions were good. The money was good.
Yeah.
So that's probably a highlight of my career.
I bet. So you also said you wrestled in Puerto Rico. When did you go to Puerto Rico?
That was when after I beat Stormy Granzer. You know, I was saying that I thought I had some opportunities then.
Yeah.
And,
was that
when I first got the championship? That must have been about 83 or 84. Soon after I won the championship, WWA,
yeah.
Stormy Granzer. I got the opportunity to go to Puerto Rico for a summer. I was only there, kind of family issues again. I was only there 3-4 weeks. But I had a great tour. And then Ric Flair took a liking to me.
Yeah.
He was coming in on the weekends doing the main events and stuff. And he hooked me up with the Atlanta promotion at the time, the Turner Broadcasting.
Yeah, right.
So I went home from Puerto Rico a little bit early. I was going to go down there. I was packed and all ready to go, and I got the call that the TBS, that promotion down there, they disbanded. You probably know more about this than me, but I think that's when the WWF took over promotion down there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, bought out the TBS time slot. Yeah, the whole Black Saturday thing.
So I was looking to go big time, but I went down there. I was going to take maybe a year. I'll take professional leave for a year. But that, you know, that didn't work out, so that was the end of that, I guess.
Yeah, so you were prepared to go to Georgia, to Atlanta and work when McMahon bought the time slot and there for a bit killed off the Georgia wrestling. You were set to go there and that messed that up.
I was also, I had the car packed and everything. Yeah, that was, I thought, well, here's my ticket. I'm going to make the big time, but it just didn't work out. So it's probably for the best.
Yeah.
Things probably worked out for the best. Family issues and stuff, that's more important. And I retired from teaching.
Sure. And
I don't have any no complaints, but I'm glad I did the pro wrestling.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you also you made a couple of appearances for WWE in Detroit there in the mid '80s. How did that go? And what was that like?
It's nice being on the big stage. It was nice, and I got the chance to meet Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant in the dressing room and stuff. Andre is big as what you fathom. He could. My hand just sunk in his hand. I shook hands with him.
Yeah.
He had to turn. He had to duck and turn sideways to get in the normal dressing room door and stuff.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. I met some of the high shows and stuff. It was enjoyable. They treated me nice. They treated me good.
Yeah. They just. Did they ever try to call you again and have a discussion with you about the travel thing, or did nothing just come from there?
Just worked a few times locally. Maybe West Virginia. Couple times down there, maybe once in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Just you know, fill up their local card and stuff. That's all right. No complaints with them either. They treated me good.
Yeah. And then on June 25th, 1989, probably had one of the most widely known matches of your wrestling career when you did the boxer versus wrestler match with Leon Spinks. So, how did that come about? And what was it like working with Leon?
That was a good time. I got in good shape. That's probably the best shape of my life. I lost about 15 pounds. I was doing a lot of road work, and we did it for a charity here, the Pro Vocal, the Victims of Childhood Abuse Laws. Mm-hmm. And we drew a pretty good crowd. I think we made them some money, and it was a good show. It was right here in Toledo. It's good. You know, I wouldn't want to be a boxer. I know that much. I had a headache for about 3 days. I whipped him easy. I mean, I was able to, you know, his sucker rules, because he had to wear gloves and I didn't have to wear any.
Yeah.
So I was able to attack his legs and stuff, but he hit me a few times and I was dazed.
Yeah.
I got respect for that business. I trained a lot to learn how to block punches and stuff.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I
got in good shape.
Yeah, I mean, it must have, you know, you working with Leon must have been good and everything. Cause, you know, I mean, you had a rematch in '93 with him. You did it again. Did you and Leon stay in touch during that time, or did somebody just come up and said, "Hey, let's do it again"? Or how did that happen?
Just through the Pro Vocal people. Every now and then we keep in touch. Jerry kept in touch with his manager, I think, a little bit too. So.
Gotcha. All right. Well. Yeah, like I said, a lot of people, even non-wrestling.
Leon died recently. You know that?
Yeah.
Bless his soul.
Yeah.
He's a good man.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people, like I said, a lot of people remember that, that match with Spinks. Even guys that weren't familiar with Bruiser Balaam or WWA remember Wojo versus Spinks. And I hear about that a lot.
Yeah.
So, and then, I mean, by this time, I mean, you were still doing the occasional wrestling spot here and there, but I mean, like you said, it cut back a lot. But then in 99, you suffered a dissected aorta that was kind of scary. What happened with that? How did that happen?
I was just working out at the gym with a local high school kid. And I worked out with him every Saturday. And about 8 Saturdays in a row, and I was bragging to myself in a way. I jogged 3 miles in a park the day before, and I was really starting to get my timing back. I was 48 years old already. Mm-hmm. Really feeling good about doing this amateur wrestling, and we were just starting to warm up. Wasn't any strenuous. I felt a bolt of lightning went through my head, and then I had a lingering. I didn't lose consciousness. I had lingering pressure under my sternum. I knew that's a warning for a heart problem.
Sure.
So I asked. It was 95 degrees that day. I asked the guy at the gym, Torrio. I asked Torrio, "Hey, better call 911. I don't want to try to drive to the hospital, but something's up."
Yeah.
So I'd almost lost my life. I was 6.5 hours open heart surgery. By the time they got to me, I know never lost consciousness. They put me under, but I could feel my lungs filling up with blood. By the time they got to me, it tore all the way through, and they had to replace the valve, and they had trouble patching it up. But 21 years later, Michael Morales was my surgeon, and praise the Lord.
Yeah. And I'd heard you say. I think I read an article or something that actually just a few days later or within a week, you had a booking somewhere, right? And that if you thought about, man, if it had happened there, it might have been a different story altogether.
Then next Saturday, Jerry and I are booked somewhere up in Michigan, right? Maybe in the Lansing area, maybe. I'm not sure. And, it's a small town. It's a small town. I probably would never survive.
Yeah. It's wild.
I'd have probably tried to drive home to Toledo, and I probably died on the way in the car. You know?
Yeah. It's wild how things like that work out sometimes.
Yeah.
So you said you got no regrets on your career, but when you look back on your pro career, what do you think of? What are some of the highlights for you or your general feeling of your years pro?
Well, my highlights were the trip to Puerto Rico was fantastic. And the trip to Japan, fantastic. I used to like driving to Indy too. We drove to Indy quite a bit. So,
yeah.
I don't have any regrets because Jerry and I were a good team together too.
Yeah,
I drove at night.
Absolutely.
He drive during the day. I drive at night. So we had some fun. We made some money. I did it within a normal life framework too. Same as the amateur wrestling. I was teaching, I had kids, but I still, I guess I did it my way.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah, I'm from the central Indiana area. When you were in Indianapolis, did you have any favorite restaurants, favorite hangout? I mean, any place that, you know, after show you would get a bite to eat? Any favorites there?
You know, we were just all business. We'd get done working and we'd off to the next town. Some days we have 2 or 3 day trips. Some days just one. We'd be back 5 in the morning and be going to work the next day.
Yeah.
So.
Whew. Yeah.
It wasn't that glamorous like a lot of people think it would be.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a lot of people. Jerry's always said that you're a very humble person, despite everything that you've ever accomplished. That you're kind of quiet, kind of reserved. And I know that the business chews up a lot of people and spits them out, and I think it's pretty great that you know, like you said, you did it your way. You've come out on the other side better. You know, you had your normal life along with getting to travel and do some of these things. I think you also wrestled Canada a bit, didn't you, for George Cannon and did some spots up there, didn't you?
Oh yeah, George Cannon, yeah, Windsor, London, Ontario. We did a lot of Ontario, you know, all parts in between in Ontario.
Yeah. So
Cannon helped me get started too. He's a good man.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So I know you and Jerry stay in touch and everything else. Is there anybody else from the business that you kind of stay in touch with and talk to every once in a while, or
just once in a while, every couple of years? Jim Rasky, I made the Lou Trago, Lou says George Trago Hall of Fame, Dan Gable mm-hmm. Museum up there sure. in Waterloo, Iowa,
yep.
And Rasky was there, so we got reacquainted there. My wives met and everything, and so I've kept in touch with him a little bit. He's one of my favorite guys.
Yeah.
Baron Fritz von Rasky. Remember him from the pro wrestling?
I do. Absolutely do. Yeah. Sure do.
He's still got that claw. That claw.
That's right. Still, he's still working that gimmick, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Even signing pictures and stuff there. Yeah, it got over good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've had a lot of guys from Bruiser Bedlam on my show, and I've always spoke highly of you. I had Chris Carter on. He was fun to be, you know, talk to and everything else. Do you? What are your memories of Chris Carter?
Oh, we were on the same cards a lot. He's working for Bruiser a lot. He worked for George Cannon a lot too.
Yeah.
So he and I started about the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every now and then we travel together even too.
Yeah. Yeah. For a few years I did some managing and wrestling just in Indiana, just small stuff. But one of the guys that helped me get started and helped train me was a Calypso Jim. So I talked to him, you know, semi regularly. So, and I know you and Calypso had a lot of matches back in Bedlam.
Yeah, and we talked too. I should have mentioned him. We talked. He gave me a call out of the blue, maybe about four or five months ago, right before I had hip surgery.
Yeah.
And him and then El Becerro. Mm-hmm.
Jose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had Jose.
Jose Martinez. Yeah. Jose Martinez. Yeah. We talked too. So yeah.
Yep, I've had him on my show too.
So I made some friends, and then, you know, Don Kent, bless his soul, he was one of my best friends in the business too.
Yeah.
He stayed at my house a few times. He gave me coaching tips for my boys when they played football.
Yeah. So. I've always said Don Kent's one of the most underappreciated names in pro wrestling. He was such a great worker. So.
Oh yeah, great worker, good man, good man. He helped hook me up with that trip to Japan, I think, and Puerto Rico too.
Puerto Rico, yeah, because he booked the Puerto Rico and stuff. It helped a lot down there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always say, him and Jerry were a great team. They
He'd
were great.
He'd be an unsung hero in pro wrestling, I guess, to be Don Kent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and he was another guy that kind of did a lot on the, you know, kept some of his normal life, too. He was, I think he did a lot of, didn't he do some teaching and coaching and stuff, too, through the years?
Yeah, he coached, he was from Battle Creek, Michigan. He coached, he's coaching a high school there, I believe.
Yeah. I've talked to his daughter several times about her dad's stuff, and he's another guy that kind of did it on his own terms. Let's do one thing real quick. What did you, when you heard that Bruiser died, where were you? I mean, who called you? What did you think of hearing of Bruiser dying? I think he was in Florida when he died.
Yeah, I think it was Jerry, Dr. Graham gave me a call and told him about that. Yeah, I felt bad. I felt bad. He's, you know, he's good to me. He's a good man.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. Even all these years later, I mean, everybody in Indiana's got a Dick the Bruiser story. They all have, you know, running into him somewhere or seeing him somewhere or their dad told him a story or something. Everybody's got a Bruiser story. So
he wasn't that old, but he reminded me of my grandpa, just a rugged, old school type of tough guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Wojo, I won't keep you too much longer. We've had you on here for a bit, and I appreciate it. I know you don't do a lot of interviews, so I'm really honored that you agreed to talk to us, and the listeners are excited to hear from you. And, you know, who knows, maybe down the road we'll have you on again. We'll chat some more and when we get some feedback and everything else, and hopefully we stay in touch. But like I said, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us and appearing on the show.
I usually try to keep a low profile, but this has been fun.
Got to give him credit. I can't believe it. He picked up 368 pounds in a body slam. Not only that, did everybody see Bruiser back down for me? Did you see it? He didn't have enough guts to get up. He didn't have enough guts to get up. Why not? Because he's scared of me.
Bruiser is afraid of Graham. Everybody's afraid of Graham and me. You saw it. That's why they called me the Great Wojo. I picked him up like he was a feather. I need some competition. Give me some competition.
Certainly a massive display of the power and strength of the Great Wojo. I still can't believe it.
Well, you better start believing it. This is the man that has $100,000 to any other professional wrestler in any commission, federation, league, alliance to wrestle him belt for belt, and not one of them has accepted for $100,000. This man is the most feared man in wrestling. This man has got $100,000 and nobody, not one champion from any alliance, federation, or commission will give him the match. So I give you, by default, the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. Where are these other so-called champions? I've been challenging them for a year. I am the greatest heavyweight today. I'm the greatest heavyweight ever.
Okay, and thank you to Jerry for coming on and talking. I know, you know, I've known Jerry for a while. Jerry handles things very well, everything. But I know how much his hurts, right? You could tell, you could hear it, right? A friend for 60 plus years, someone he spoke to in some capacity every week, usually multiple times for pretty much his entire life, and you know that's and now that's gone. So that's a tough thing. So again, we'd like to, you know, send our thoughts out to Jerry and every other person who was friends with or an acquaintance with or who worked with Wojo. Obviously we'd like to send, you know, good vibes out to his family. And obviously, you know, I would even, you know, for those of us who were mostly fans, right? I mean, like I said, I got to know Wojo a little bit, but for those of us who watched Wojo and were just fans and just appreciated that side of him, you know, even then that still hurts in a way. So, you know, the Great Wojo was a great one, no pun intended, or maybe a pun is intended. I don't know, but, he will truly be missed. And, yeah. So, and obviously I wanted, when that happened, you know, I wanted to reshuffle. Obviously I was going to do a tribute episode to the Great Wojo. That's just a no brainer, right? So, that's what I wanted to do. So, but we will be back next week with another episode. And, next week will actually be the 300th episode of Wrestling Nostalgia. That kind of snuck up on me. So yay for that. And on that episode, I have a pretty cool guest. I will have none other than Dangerous Dan Spivey will be on next week's episode, our 300th. So that sounds cool. Once again, thank you, Wojo, for all the memories. You know, good thoughts out to everybody who Wojo meant something to. So, guys, we'll see you next week. Wherever you go, whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.
Wrestling Nostalgia is copyright Dave Dynasty, Bruiser voice done by John Lawson.